Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are talking with Carl Safina. You're talking about trees. You're talking about rivers. You're talking about wild animals known as fish. You're talking about politics and economics. You cannot separate the politics and economics from these things about the wild things, can you?
No. And you can't separate human communities from them either.
You spend an entire elegant, beautiful book telling individual stories. You talk about people living little lives and big lives. You talk about wild animals and their individual lives. Isn't that sort of the mosaic that you're saying from the big to the small, that we also have to have some sense from the small to the big, that we are talking about individual lives and they do come together into something bigger than the sum of the parts?
Well,
a romantic here?
Whether it's bigger than the sum of the parts, I'm not sure. I think a lot of these connections are not the things that we think about every day. I don't think they're very subtle. I mean, to me, the reason that I wrote a book that included all of them was because they were all so obviously important after I started looking into it that I couldn't say, well, I won't talk about the politics, or I won't talk about the economics, or I won't talk about the biology. It's all pretty obviously important, but it's not something that we normally think of.
It also is staggering. I could be very depressed about this book. There are a lot of challenges, and yet in the context of that, we were talking with a guest just a couple of weeks ago, and I asked the obvious stupid question of are you optimistic or pessimistic? And he looked at me. And he said, "I knew you'd ask that." He said, "That's the wrong question." He said, "The question is, what are we going to do?" Is that part of how we begin to deal with the incredibly complex set of challenges that you... I mean, after you've ripped my heart out, are you going to put it back in and tell me what to do about this?
Well, I tried hard to find heroes to talk about who point the way, and I think that although a lot of the news is very disconcerting, shall we say, there are people who are struggling, not unrealistically. They realize that they have a big problem on their hands, and they're doing what they can to deal with it, and they're making inroads. We have seen during the 1990s a much greater awareness of what's happening in the ocean. We've recovered some of the fish populations, including the ones right on the Atlantic coast right here. We've shown that it can work. It needs much broader application, but just one thing that is, I think, emblematic of a new concern about the oceans is the United Nations has called 1997 the year of the reef and 1998 the year of the oceans. And so on some level, they are getting it that these are massively important things that the world needs to turn a lot more attention to.
That to me, raises an interesting... Part of what's going on seems to be global marketization. From a purely business standpoint, much of what you describe, for all it is deplorable from other perspectives, makes eminent good sense from a business standpoint. Just the hardcore economics of it look like it is perfectly plausible to go, use an example, take all the tuna out of the sea. You know, the present value of a tuna, as opposed to the discounted present worth of a tuna stream over... The discounted may be more, but not for me individually. From an individual business standpoint, it would seem that, you know, these are good business decisions. Typically, when you have those kinds of externalities, the kinds of problems that go along with that, you look to your government to provide some sort of counterforce in that. I raise that because where's the government in all this? You mentioned the United Nations, but their ability to make things happen is fairly limited.
Well, the United States has one of the best governments in the world in terms of our democratic institutions, but we've had a long struggle in the history of civilization for control, mostly by people who have control over property and resources, who want to keep control away from the majority of people who are working for them to enrich them by extracting those resources. There have been a whole bunch of revolutions in the course of Western civilization alone to try to get more power in the hands of more of the people. And in the United States, that was done in the late 1700s. And in the 1800s, there were laws limiting the power of corporations. But I would say my view of recent history is that corporations have regrouped and they've learned that they can turn democratic institutions on their head by co-opting them, by buying their representatives. All you need to do is make sure that the people you want in there that you can control are the people whose candidacies you support with campaign contributions, and then they are beholden to you. And instead of serving the public interest, they serve a very special private corporate interest. And that's why, in my view, a lot of these problems are allowed to continue, because there is no counterbalancing public interest and public accountability through the democratic process.
You also talk about,
not to say that there is none, but that it is seriously compromised nowadays.
You also talk about globalization itself removing decision making from national structures, and in fact, in some ways, just overwhelming the democratic process. That it's now the decisions are made in the stock exchanges rather than in the democratic processes that we talk a lot about.
Well, instead of conducting business in a human context that encompasses a lot of different values, such as making products that people will like, for lives that people should have, with concerns over ethics and human well-being, and instead of having business in a human context, we now have humanity in a business context, and I think that's very scary.
That's very interesting. I never thought of markets as a monoculture, as enforcing a monoculture with all the dangers that it represents. It seems, too, that there's also, and as you describe it, another piece of that, which is the curious manipulation of language.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, harvest, but you know, mm-hmm. when you know, at some point, it really, sections of your descriptions, particularly the tuna wars, but also some of what's gone on in the Northwest, it looked like I had the sense of having dropped down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
you mean it was just crazy?
Where red is white and black is green and words don't mean anything, and people will stand and say the most absurd things with a straight face, and policies are made on the basis of that.
Yes, and they repeat them so often that they co-opt everybody's perspective and way of thinking in a very subtle way. Now,
is that sort of like lying to yourself?
Yes, and as I say in the book, people think that humans are distinguished by our ability to use tools and have language, and I sometimes think that the most singular human trait is our ability to deceive ourselves.
What you're talking about is facilitated denial.
It's partly denial, but part of it is just a desire to lie to people. I mean, this thing about using the word harvest to talk about cutting down trees that have been standing for 500 or 1,000 years, or catching wild animals out of the ocean, that is reinforced PR ploy to make people think that removing the rainforests of the Northwest is the same as agriculture, or they talk about harvesting whales as though hunting whales is the same as picking watermelons or harvesting wheat. It is not the same. We have hunter-gathering societies and we have agricultural societies. These distinctions are real. They make a difference, but by trying to blur it all together, we try to make something that is unsustainable and violent sound like the same thing that seems benign and benevolent.
There is also an attack, it seems to be, or has been, I don't know if it continues, a systematic attack on the science itself. That we don't believe the scientists are in the ecologist, the environmentalist back pocket, or we don't have enough evidence yet.
Yeah, well, that's always the first.
It does sound like the tobacco wars, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. The consultants always cast aspersions on uncertainties in the science. The thing is, science works within a range of uncertainty. That's how science works. So there's always some uncertainty in science. But if you look at the predictions and projections and status assessments that have been made in fisheries that many people have attacked, they have been right almost 100% of the time. And The other thing is, that is sort of curious, whenever scientists say things are declining or we need to go slower or we need to cut back, everybody says, oh, there's too much uncertainty. We can't possibly act based on that kind of information. But when the scientists have said in the last couple of years that in the closed areas of the fishing banks in New England, the abundance of cod has started to turn a corner, still at a very low level, but beginning to increase, you don't hear any single person say that they don't believe that. Everybody is willing to jump with both feet on any glimmer of good news, and no matter...
regardless of the source.
Well, even if it's the same people who, if those same people give them any bad news, they refuse to believe it.
The scientist you are listening to is Carl Safina, who is an adjunct professor at Yale University, and he's also the program director of the National Audubon Society's Living Oceans Program. We're going to be back for a couple more minutes with Carl Safina. Stay tuned.